not free. The people you ask for freedom are not free. Not free. 12 men on the jury in the town, never letting the guilty down, never realizing the criminals are the judges.
CKUT is a messenger, teaching the youth about roots and culture, and tell the massive empty member jar. That's all I need when I am. CKUT is a messenger, teaching the youth about roots and culture, and tell the massive empty member jar. That's all I heard in with I got. Well, 90.3 FM. It's CKUT, the culture.
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. CKUT, 90.3 FM.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Legalese, a broadcast about law cast broadly. Bienvenue à Legalese, une émission consacrée aux droits qui vise à en rendre le jargon plus accessible tout en évaluant de manière critique ses institutions. I'm Christophe, your host for this month's edition of Legalese. Today on the show, we'll be talking about proof of vaccination policies in Canadian universities and explore why Quebec universities stand out. Unlike many of their counterparts across the country, universities in Quebec have so far opted not to adopt proof of vaccination requirements on their campuses. Before the start of the fall semester, a group of McGill profs banded together with one major demand of the administration: that it impose a vaccine mandate. The administration was quick to shut down the idea. It insists that such a mandate violates the law in Quebec. Richard Gold is a professor at McGill's faculties of law and medicine. He's been advocating for a stricter health policy at the university. He spoke to Legalese's co-producer, Michelle Pucci. Here's their conversation.
Before we get started, could you just introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Richard Gold. I'm a professor at the Faculty of Law and also in the Faculty of Medicine.
So back in August, you signed not one, but two letters proposing new COVID-19 protocol at McGill. Can you explain just briefly what the demands are?
So the letter was really addressed to the legal issues that the university put forward. The university claimed at various dates that it could not impose any type of requirement in respect of vaccines, coming up with different reasons that changed and never really explained itself. What we addressed was a proposal that had been addressed, series of steps adopted by other universities, both in the United States, over 700, and across Canada. And it involved a proof of vaccination requirement to attend classes. Could be implemented in a variety of ways. So the first obligation was that students, staff, and faculty would have to show some documentation. So in Quebec, that's relatively easy. For people vaccinated elsewhere, there are other documents that could be used unless they sought an exemption. And there are human rights, regular human rights exemptions that are recognized. For example, if they had a medical condition that prevented them from getting a vaccine. Those are quite narrow because even most people with allergies, they can still get the vaccine and they benefit a lot more from the vaccine than not. But there was that exemption. The other was for religious reasons. There are only a few religions that actually prohibit vaccines, but we needed to recognize that. For those individuals, the proposal was, just as it is across Canada and the United States, that those individuals take twice weekly or three times a week testing. It could be PCR testing, it could be rapid testing, but some type of testing procedure. There would also need to be a transition period because you're announcing the requirement now in the middle of classes, but even then it takes at least 4 weeks between the doses and then getting a time for it to become fully effective. So during that transition period, students would, or staff or faculty, would undergo testing. So they would have to, with it by a certain date, get their first vaccine, continue testing, and have their second vaccine by a certain date, demonstrate proof of vaccination. And during that period, plus the 2 weeks it takes after the second vaccine to take effect, they would have to do regular testing. That was the proposal. There were other elements of McGill's health plan that others had mentioned, and we only tangentially addressed because they didn't really rise to the level of legal barrier that the university had raised, but was part of the multi-layered approach that virtually every other university has in terms of protecting its entire community. So we didn't really get into that, but there's a letter almost, I think the day after, by colleagues across campus, and a letter specifically from the School of Population and Global Health that addressed those other health issues in addition to this requirement to upload proof of vaccination.
And so you mentioned right at the end there that it would be sort of an uploading of proof, because I think for many of us, it would be hard to imagine what would a mandate like this look like. Would it be people standing? Would it be security at the Rotter gates? Would it be in front of every building at McGill?
So different universities take different approaches, and all of those approaches should be considered and pick the best one. Universities in the United States generally treated the uploading of the proof of vaccination as equivalent to a transcript. So if you don't upload your transcript to McGill, you wouldn't be registered. It was just a requirement for registration. A number of US universities took that approach. So it was a one-time uploading, obviously with a transition period for those who didn't, or an uploading of an exemption that had been granted. So one or the other, but it's a one-time affair, and you either registered or not. So that's one approach. A different approach at some Canadian universities, such as at Sheridan, which was the first one, was they would have their own kind of pass. We might be able to use the Quebec passport, but as they entered, there was a machine, and you just read it, and there'd be, you know, guards checking to make sure that at least you did that. So that was a different approach, but it's more intensive. I'm not exactly sure why Sheridan chose that rather than the registration requirement, which is the simplest. Another would be, they got cards that indicated whether it had one dose, two doses, something. Again, we have our passport with a different color, so it would be relatively easy just to show it and have it scanned as you go in. So those are the options. That it becomes a question of public health and the best way to implement it, which one of these options. There's an elegance to the registration requirement. I'm not exactly sure why more Canadian universities have not used that, but either of these would work, but that's something you're not gonna hand over to lawyers to decide. You want the people who actually understand the public health and the mechanisms of registration and all the implications of that to determine the best pathway. What it is not is guards surrounding McGill campus, and anybody who walks across campus has to show a pass. It would really be to attend inside buildings. I do not currently know what they're doing in the libraries since they just announced this, but it would be equivalent. It could be equivalent to that, but in the various buildings.
And so we'll mention the library being added to the list of places that a passport or proof of vaccination is required in a bit. But I just wanted to go through the legal issues that I think come to mind to most people and were in the letters that were signed by the professors from the Faculty of Law. So I'll just sort of list them and then ask for your thoughts on this. So the first, I guess, legal issue is if we're considering university as an essential service, wouldn't making a vaccination mandatory exclude people that are already marginalized or would be otherwise entitled to receive these services?
So the simple answer is no, and this has been studied not just by the signatories to that letter, but by professors across Canada, because it's not a uniquely Quebec question, even though the term essential service is, but every province considers higher education as well as elementary and secondary education is critical, whether they use the term essential or not. And this is why a transition period is so important, right? If we had announced this in June, it would be one thing. But the universities are easily capable of providing vaccination services on campus. McGill did not do a good job at the beginning. They had a one-day clinic that was oversubscribed. They're doing better now. But you would need to provide an availability for this. And, you know, if students felt ill, they could go home and not have to attend class, et cetera. One could have accommodated. So it's clear that there were some people who were hesitant or simply couldn't access it. You know, they were in low-paying jobs. They were afraid of, you know, they couldn't get the time off. And if they got sick, they would lose their money. One could understand that. And that's why the transition period is so important. It's also important to engage the community, talking to, you know, the SSMU, PGSS, the various student associations, Black Law students, whatever, across campus, because the people who have suffered the most in both Canada and the United States have been the more marginalized people who get, when they get COVID, don't, you know, have had the highest level of poor outcomes. So it's really important to reach them. And this is not about stigmatizing those who aren't vaccinated. That would be a huge mistake. It's an institutional mistake, and we can blame the institution for not setting up a program that enables people and encourages people to get vaccinated. But to lay blame on individuals is a huge mistake. So you would have to address that, but every other campus across Canada has had to deal with this, every campus across the United States. So it's not an insurmountable barrier. And given how late we are to the game, we have plenty of examples to look at in order to determine what's the best way of ensuring everybody had access. So in our view, in our legal analysis, really, there's nothing incompatible between a proof of vaccination requirement and access to the campus, access to an essential service. And by essential service, you know, it's conditioned by a whole bunch of behavior. If you misbehave, you don't get to stay on campus, et cetera. But in order to really live up to this expectation that students should be able to get an education, the university has the responsibility to do that. But we have a medical school, one of the best medical schools in the world. We have associated hospitals. We're already doing some of the works, for example, that Montreal Public Health has given to McGill to do some contact tracing. So we're already engaged in the process. And if we can't provide that type of service to our more marginalized parts of our community, then, you know, we're in the wrong business.
I guess similarly, but perhaps not, if we're looking only at employees and the relationship between the university as an employer imposing potentially this vaccination mandate on employees, what are the how would that be overcome if we're thinking that Quebec has some of the strongest labor rights in the country?
Certainly where there's a union, the first step is to talk to the unions and look for flexibility in terms of how you do this. So we've been living online for 18 months. The administrative staff is mostly still not in person. So one could imagine that those employees who, for whatever reason, are not vaccinated, for not all positions, but for many positions, could be accommodated within the McGill framework. And that would be negotiated with the unions. So the unions themselves and the employees within these unions want to be surrounded by vaccinated people too. So there is a way to accommodate that and try to build some flexibility. But the only way you know that is by talking to people and engaging the union. So there's that. Much of our staff is not unionized. The professors are not unionized. And so there, the considerations are different. Major corporations in Quebec have mandated some type of proof of vaccination. The law firms that are in Montreal are doing so. Nobody seems to believe that in the middle of a global pandemic, when we're in a declared fourth wave, that requiring vaccinations presents an insurmountable hurdle. What it does require is dialogue, flexibility, understanding to achieve your goal and to phase it in. But we recognize that it will take time to do that properly. Unfortunately, McGill should have been doing this in July and certainly in August. And by failing to do so, we're put in a position where that dialogue is very difficult.
Moving on, so you mentioned the exceptions that would be, you know, that are kind of guaranteed required because not everyone can get the vaccine for one reason or another. One thing that has been reported in these past days has been the increase in number of people seeking these medical and religious exceptions. Is it feasible for McGill to become this sort of arbiter about whether one person's exception is valid versus another's?
Well, we do it all the time for accommodation for a whole whack of services. Students are constantly have open to them accommodation. So if McGill is claiming that it can't do that, that's a very poor commentary on our general ability to accommodate students. This is really no different. As I said, every other U15 university outside of Quebec has figured this out. 700 plus universities in the United States have figured it out. This is not groundbreaking. People have done it. One would hope that there is a fast process that's not overly generous, that, you know, I don't feel like it is not an excuse to get an exemption, that it's real, but at the same time has to be relatively quick. If I look at University of Virginia, for example, about 27,000 students, and if I remember correctly, they had, I can't remember, it was between 300 and 600 students who got an exemption. So that's what you're looking at. And we deal with exemptions for all kinds of things at a much higher rate at McGill. And noticeably, only 49 students who were registered for this fall were deregistered for failure to get a vaccine. So we're talking about a vanishingly small percentage of campus that will refuse to get a vaccine. There are a whole bunch of hesitant people. There are some people who might prefer not to, but will do it. So McGill has constructed a policy to cater to an exceedingly small group of individuals while putting a much larger group at risk.
On the topic of sort of these Quebec charter and Canadian charter rights that everyone is talking about these days, but possibly do not understand. But if we're looking specifically at people who may have a disability or may be among the most high at risk, I think your argument has been that not having this mandate actually discriminates against these people. Could you just speak a bit more about that?
Sure. And what's particularly interesting is while the university has said they don't have the legal right, they never disputed the discrimination. They've had two letters that said it. There's been a number of other claims by students themselves, including the PGSS, claiming discrimination. One would think if the university had a case, they would advance it, which they have not. The claim is pretty simple, right? The university, so there's some debate whether universities are covered by the Canadian Charter, not much debate that it's covered by the Quebec Charter. All those who have looked at the issue, those at the substantive, assuming that it applies, have said in the middle of a pandemic, there's no problem. So that side is gone. On the discrimination side is McGill has a choice of policies. And if it makes a choice that systemically discriminates against identifiable people, then it is discriminating under the law. Right? You don't have to purposely discriminate against a particular individual, but if you have policies that you know are going to adversely affect certain populations rather than others, then that is discrimination, both under McGill's internal policies, because the harassment and discrimination policy is specific. It acknowledges systemic discrimination, so under its own internal laws, but also the Quebec Charter. And the argument is there is abundant scientific evidence, even from the Quebec government, that certain groups have a disability that put them at higher risk. And there are two types of risk here. One is anybody who is immunosuppressed has some level less protection from the vaccine than someone who isn't immunosuppressed. And it could be they got very little to a slightly diminished amount. Recently, there has been the availability of a third dose, but even that takes time to kick in. And so those who benefited from them certainly have spent them, you know, are spending the month of September without that benefit. And it's still unclear how protected they are. So that's one group who, even though vaccinated, don't get the full level of protection. And therefore, if exposed to the virus, have a higher risk of contracting a disease. And often the underlying disease, the reason why they're immunosuppressed, makes them at higher risk. The other group are people for whom the vaccine works like anybody else, but if they get sick, the evidence is showing that they are at higher risk of a more serious outcome. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going into ICU and hopefully not dying, but they could be incapacitated for longer. Like, everybody is subject to some level of incapacity, right? Between 14 and 30% of those who are infected have long COVID with very much, a whole bunch of different conditions, some more serious than others, could be fainting and headaches, could be loss of focus, et cetera. But these individuals are more likely to have to be away from school and lose time, et cetera. So those two groups exist, those who are immunosuppressed and those who will get are more likely to encounter a serious outcome. Now, before Delta, when the risk of being infected and having anything serious happen to you was quite small, perhaps one could have justified it. But since we've known for months that Delta was out there, we've certainly known that it's been in Canada for several months, it's clear that there are more breakthrough cases. So even if you have a regular immune system, you are still at risk. Your risk is much less. I mean, there's no doubt that than if you were unvaccinated. But if you are infected, you have a higher risk than other people, and that's known to the administration. Second group would be pregnant women. There's very good evidence that pregnant women themselves are at risk, but also at risk of premature delivery. So their offspring could suffer health consequences, hopefully short term, but you don't know. If you give premature birth, that's always a risk. Don't want it. So that's second group. So first group are those who are disabled, either because they're immunocompromised or have a health condition that's serious enough. It's not every health condition. Usually it's certain types of health conditions with a factor that makes it worse. But there are a number of people around campus that fit within it. And then pregnant women. And the third group are people based on family status, because many of us, students, faculty, staff, live in a family, some multi-generational, with people who are susceptible. So the other groups may be, my spouse might be pregnant, I'm taking care of an elderly parent, they might be in a retirement home, and therefore if I get infected, even though I might only get mild symptoms, I might be infectious, because that's the other thing we know about Delta, is that even if you get it, you are more infectious than under previous variants. And the science there is evolving. So if I have just a very mild case, chances are, or a very mild case or asymptomatic, there's a good chance I'm not that infectious. But if I have a slightly more one, don't have to go to the hospital, but still, I could infect others. And the problem also is I won't find out about it. I'm infectious before I get symptomatic. So those are the three classes. So the university knows, based on very solid evidence, that those categories of individuals are put at risk. And on a protected basis, right? So we recognized pregnancy as part of sex discrimination under the charter. It's actually listed in McGill's own policies. We recognize disability as a listed category and family status as a listed category. So here is a protected class of individuals where the science tells the university that they are at particular risk. Now, what could the university do? Well, in a world with nothing, they can't do anything, right? If there are no vaccines and there's nothing, then they're not discriminating because we're all in the same bucket. But that's not the case. We see that all the big universities across Canada, except in Quebec, the major ones in the United States, 700 plus, have all adopted multiple layers of protection that have become the standard way to do it. So McGill has chosen not to meet that standard, and not meet it just by a little bit, but not meet it by a lot. We are the worst of the U15. Even our Quebec, other Quebec U15 universities are taking greater steps to protect their population, short of the best thing to do, which is a vaccine requirement. The public health experts said the best way to do it is a proof of vaccination, because it will probably give us an extra 10%, move us from 86% to almost 100% of the population being vaccinated. That's a huge effect, because it means the virus is not able to stay very long, even if it enters into the community.
I guess, so building off that, if we're thinking about what McGill can do and what it says it can do, going back, you know, all of these measures are at a provincial level are happening because the Quebec government has the power to, in a public health emergency in this context, to impose measures like a passport or mask mandates, etc. Does McGill have that same authority? Can it go beyond what the Quebec government has said is, you know, the standard, at least for the province?
Clearly it does, and even McGill recognizes it, because McGill brought in a mask mandate a week or so prior to the province. So clearly it had the authority to surpass the provincial level. The province provides a floor of protection, and then it's up to each institution to determine how much beyond that floor it wants to go, given all the circumstances. So you see private employers who have no obligation to go beyond that, going far beyond that.
So on the legal, more rightsy questions, I have two more sort of points. They're kind of related, but not really. Privacy being one, can McGill even collect this kind of information, especially if we're talking about uploading that information to the Minerva or Moodle of the university? And, on a health and medical, you know, one of the arguments has been, as a vaccination is a medical procedure, we cannot force people to have a vaccine. That's the gist of the argument.
Yeah. So on the first point on privacy, we demand all kinds of information from you, which frankly is far more intrusive than knowing whether you had or did not have a vaccine, right? I know your date of birth. I think we have your social insurance number. We have any health issues you have that has for seeking an accommodation. We know your parents. We know your gender. We know your grades. This is minor comparison to that. And we're already demanding it for pubs, the library. So the privacy concern is a minimal concern. If we were outside the pandemic, could we be asking? I think that's a legitimate question, but it's so far from our reality that nobody believes that there's a privacy concern. So Professor Cafone, who's an expert in privacy, thought this was a slam dunk argument, you can do it. So the argument about privacy, no. In terms of the forced medical procedure, I mean, this is reminiscent of kind of the anti-vaxxers in the United States saying you're forcing a vaccine on us. I mean, it's been debunked for generations, right? What we're saying is you can choose to get a vaccine or not. No one's going to follow you to a vaccine clinic and stick something in your arm. However, when you make a choice, there are consequences. So let's say I wear glasses and I want to drive my car. My car license might be conditioned upon me wearing glasses, right? That's common. And I choose not to wear glasses and they arrest me. And I say, well, I chose not to because you're forcing me to wear this class. I mean, it's a ridiculous argument, right? I choose to engage in the activity of driving. I choose to come to campus. It's a separate question whether the university tries to provide online services and alternatives to those who don't want to be vaccinated. That's a separate argument. But there is no imposition, and it's been widely recognized. We've been giving vaccines for many decades, that this is not a forced medical procedure. And it's frankly offensive when you hear your own university making such debunked arguments that sound an awful lot like the anti-vaxxer community who are saying that getting vaccines is equivalent to the Holocaust and other things. Now, I'm not saying our university went that far, thankfully, but it's all, you know, it's a very small conspiracy group who purposely misunderstands what a proof of vaccination requirement is. It is simply saying, if you choose not to do this, then there are certain consequences to your action, one of which, sorry, you can't show up in class unless you have an exemption, right? There, and that's really important to remember. It's only for those who don't want to get the vaccine because they don't want to get the vaccine, not because of some valid, recognized reason.
You're listening to Legalese on CKUT 90.3 FM. That was Michelle Pucci speaking with Richard Gold, a professor in the faculties of law and medicine who has called on McGill University's administration to implement a stricter health policy on campus. Up next is Audrey Perron speaking with Emily Black, a student in the Faculty of Arts at McGill University who has advocated for a safer return to campus to ensure that students with disabilities can continue their studies without compromising their health. She was told by the university to take a leave of absence in response to her concerns.
Okay, sure, yeah. So my name is Emily Black. I'm a fourth-year student at McGill. Doing a Bachelor of Arts in English and Communications. Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you. So actually, I like reached out to you based like on a tweet that kind of circulated and reached like our faculty, which is the law faculty, because of Professor Goad, in which you were bashing rightfully the university for like its poor handling of the pandemic and like the deleterious effect that it has on like disabled students like on the campus. So would you like to tell us more about that particular tweet and like what led you to drop it?
Yeah, for sure. So I had been doing a little bit of organizing work with some folks at SMU. Claire, who's the VP UA, and Sasha, who's VP External. And yeah, we were organizing a protest for the beginning of the year, sort of demanding a more accessible and a safer return to campus. And sort of after that happened, and, you know, after conversations I had with students and, you know, the kind of how it seemingly kind of just didn't really do much or didn't have much of an impact on the admin. You know, I was getting pretty frustrated about like all the inconsistencies in their policies and, you know, how they're just not providing a safe environment. So I, you know, tweeted about it and my situation because I kind of saw it at the beginning of the year kind of as this like choice that I have to make, you know, and I still make it every day when I go into class. And, but between, you know, going on campus and as an immunocompromised person, possibly getting COVID, which is very likely. I mean, my roommate and I already had a COVID scare because someone in her class tested positive. So we all got tested and thankfully we were okay. But yeah, it's between that and, you know, what McGill has told immunocompromised students to do, which is take a leave of absence and just drop out, basically. And for me, because I'm on financial aid, both for to go to school and to live in Montreal, I would lose my funding if I took a leave of absence. So that's not something that's possible for me. Like I probably wouldn't be able to come back and like finish my degree. So yeah, it's really like that kind of choice between, you know, being unsafe on campus, but wanting to, you know, continue my education and take part in the classes that I'm doing, or, you know, stay home and wait it out and possibly not be able to finish.
Which I was not aware that like that was the university's response. It was just like, take a leave of absence. Like I have a friend that was like supposed to start law school last year, and like the law faculty was like, oh, like kind of the same thing, like, oh, you may take a leave of absence, like blah blah blah, but they still had to like provide some like medical documentation saying that like they really needed it, and it was just like too much and like kind of inadequate too.
And I've heard of some folks that like have a medical reason but haven't, like, you know, they did the letter but it like for whatever reason wasn't accepted by McGill, so some people like aren't even able to take it like for whatever reason.
And do you know what happens for those people? Are they like not going to school and then they gotta reapply or something? Or?
I think like, yeah, if you choose to just, if you can't take a leave of absence and you just don't, like you just can't come to campus, like, yeah, you would have to like reapply, I guess. I know this, the system is weird. It's really complicated. I don't know much about it, but everyone I know that's had to take a leave of absence or tried to, it's been like a nightmare.
Yeah, no, totally, I assume. Also, can you like expose a bit like what the smooth demands were regarding like that? And you mentioned that like there was not, you know, a positive response or like inclusion within like the sort of like the university governance bodies for that. So do you want to like just maybe expose like what those demands were and like how they were received?
Yeah, for sure. So it was based off of three main demands. The first one was for a vaccine mandate to be implemented for classes and like basically more on-campus activities, because as it stood then, the only things that it was required for were like non-essential activities. And one of the examples the administration actually gave was scavenger hunts, like for frosh. So that's really fun that you need a vaccine to participate in a scavenger hunt, but not to go to class. And residences as well, which I think is a really, really key place that they should be having a vaccine mandate, because almost all of the outbreaks last year on campus were in residences. And of course you have so many students like living in close quarters, it's not their fault. Like it's really hard to, you know, adequately distance and keep everyone safe. So that was one. The second one was to provide accommodations for students, and the main two groups of students that we are thinking about are international students who, you know, may not, because of you know, visas and like borders and stuff, may not be able to come back to Montreal like right away, and they deserve, you know, accommodations so that they can still participate in their classes and, you know, do their degrees from wherever they are, and immunocompromised students like myself, who also deserve you know, so accommodations so that we can participate in our classes safely, you know, whether that means like a hybrid model, like so people can participate online from home, or, you know, just accommodations so that people in whatever situation they're in can participate in their classes safely. And then the third one is just consultation with students on COVID policies, and especially ones that have to do with on-campus safety and stuff like that, because the engagement that the McGill has allowed so far has really been limited to, you know, small events like the town halls and stuff like that, but those all had like pre-approved questions, so it really didn't feel like students could really participate because you had to submit them ahead of time, and then McGill like picked which ones they would answer, so it didn't really feel like as much of an open forum as like a town hall should be. And they, in terms of the protest, they didn't acknowledge it at all. They didn't, you know, reach out to Claire or Sasha, as far as I know, or they didn't address it in an email or anything. I think from then on, it's from what I've seen, they've mostly just been like making it up as they go along. It seems like, you know, first they said, we can't do any vaccine mandates on campus. And then they included some, and then now they added libraries. And, you know, there was that time point in time where they said that they wouldn't notify anyone if you if you had a positive case in your class, because it's, you know, they're like breach of privacy or something like that. But people have now, they're saying that like they will tell people. And I mean, I don't know for sure, but when my roommate received the email about the outbreak in her class, it was, it said it was like the, you know, the Montreal Public Health Authority asks McGill to tell you that. So I'm sure that the health authority had to step in and say, you know, you can't just like not tell people, because that's like, I'm pretty sure that's the law in Quebec that you have to, but yeah.
Yeah, I find it so, like, I haven't dived into, like, the sort of, like, excuse that they're serving for, like, not implementing a vaccination mandate on campus, which is, like, oh, no, but in Quebec, it's not possible. But I'm, like, I really doubt it, because, like, Quebec seems to have been, like, their province with, like, the stricter, like, health regulations during the pandemic. And I'm, like, if it was okay for them to, like, implement a curfew for, like, months and months and months, I'm sure that, like... You know, vaccination mandates
there,
are like
there are a there is a vaccine passport in Quebec for so many similar like similar activities and environments that have like similar like amounts of risk, I think.
Do you like or does Mu have sort of an intuition about like why McGill has been like so reluctant to like implement those demands?
Honestly, I really don't know. I'm like, I know that McGill tends to only do things when, you know, when money's on the line, like they kind of only make decisions when money's on the line. Mm-hmm. We've seen that before with so many other like student demands, like, you know, with the Change the Name campaign for the McGill sports teams and, you know, for the James McGill statue, you know, they really only make a decision once like funding is on the line. And I think that that's true with how they've dealt with things, but I honestly don't know why they're so resistant to implementing those measures, like when every other, almost every other university in Canada has.
I know that in our faculty there are some conversations right now, like between students, between like I think the majority who like support a vaccination mandate, and like some students that are like really really opposed to it, and sometimes to like vaccination in itself. Have like those conversations been happening in your faculty as well?
Not really. I mean, not as far as I know. I'm a part-time student right now, so I'm only taking a few classes and they're both pretty small. So, you know, everyone I'd say is like-minded in the way that like everyone's like wearing masks and like being respectful of that. And I think as like everyone's pretty conscious about COVID safety, but it hasn't really come up that much except for that, like, you know, just sort of chatting about like, wow, like how is McGill not, you know, implemented more stuff. And I think like when I have had conversations with my classmates, it's often like the information that I'm sharing with them, it's usually like information they're hearing for the first time, because that's the other thing too, is like McGill doesn't really publicize a lot of like the decisions that they're making, and like not everyone reads the emails that the MRO sends out. Like, that's fair. There's a lot of them. But yeah, not as much. I mean, I did, when we had the protest, I did like talk to a lot of students, you know, people who came by to the tent and wanted to talk to us either because they supported it or they didn't. I talked to several students that like were really, really against it. I don't love having those conversations because, you know, a lot of times it really easily gets into the argument that like, oh, well, immunocompromised people are such a small percentage and it doesn't matter. And, you know, and it sucks to have to like argue your right to safety against people's, you know, personal freedoms or their ability to go out to a bar and have a drink and, you know, stuff like that.
No, for sure. You know, when like the vaccination passport was like announced and like there was like a big surge in sort of vaccination registration, and I was like good that people are getting vaccinated, but like whoosh, that like, you know, being vaccinated for like protecting your community was like not a big incentive enough, and that like it is like when your ability to go to like a bar or a show or like in a restaurant is compromised, that like you're taking action. So I guess final question would be like, how can we best like support you, support SMU in this effort, and like what do you foresee in the future?
I don't know what the future has for Miguel. I really hope that we can get through the semester without, you know, having to shut down, and with as few like positive cases as possible. But, you know, I'm not very optimistic, to be honest. You know, the weather's starting to get colder, and, you know, especially since most of the classrooms don't have like any ventilation at all. And then you can't keep the windows open anymore. So I am getting a little scared. But yeah, in terms of how people can support, I guess, like, honestly, just continuing to be safe and like practicing COVID safety on campus. Cause, you know, like public health is like about all of us, and it's like a community contribution, and we all have to, you know, do our part to keep everybody safe. So just people keep, I know it sucks to like still be in the pandemic, like it sucks for everyone, most of all disabled people, but like, yeah, just keep wearing your mask and washing your hands and like being conscious, and that's probably the most helpful thing that people can do, honestly.
Really thinking of you. I'm sorry you're going in, that this is your situation right now, and like, yeah, big support.
Thank you. Yeah. And thank you for like reaching out to me. It's like, I'm glad to like talk to you and talk about this. It's good that, you know, people are still keeping the conversation going, because I think some people kind of just forgot.
Welcome back. That was Legalese's Audrey Perron speaking with Emily Black about how McGill's COVID response is failing students. The university's handling of the pandemic brought up larger issues of university governance. What role does the administration play? What about the faculty? Who actually makes decisions, and how can they be held accountable? We return to Michelle Pucci and Richard Gold to expand on some of these issues.
I want to ask more now about what's going on behind the scenes. So, you know, if we're thinking about these decisions being made by other human beings and with different levels of power. But first, I guess to start, why did you and these and the other professors at the Faculty of Law decide to write the first letter?
We've been asking the university since they asserted that they cannot require proof of vaccination to provide the legal basis for that claim. We are lawyers. We wrote to lawyers, the general counsel. Generally, when you have a legal argument, you are willing to share it and explain what is the legal basis, right? If you came and wrote an exam for me and just gave me the conclusion but didn't tell me how you got there, you would not do so well. And so we expected, when we asked our university, which is making legal claims, to just give us the basis, because we can't find it. We did that for months and we got no response. They refused to even tell us. So the general counsel, as I said, the secretary general and others refused to ever elaborate on it. And we kept hearing this argument over and over again. So we felt it incumbent upon us to look into the issue. Maybe the university was right. We were willing to look. So we looked at what we could. Now, not having the help of someone who has formulated an argument, hard to rebut something you don't even know. So we tried to look wide at a wide set of possible arguments. And we found no basis for it. And we're not the only ones, as I said. Colleagues around the country who have similar institutions found the same thing. The provost, the Rectal Jutras, who's our former dean, had concluded the same thing. He wrote to his student body, "We have, as an independent authority, the ability to do this. We choose not to for policy reasons." So that was our motivation. He did that after we wrote our letter, perhaps partly in response. But we felt we had to fill this void that the university had done. The reaction to our initial letter was, well, maybe that's not representative of the entire faculty, because you only had 12 or 13, I don't remember what we were at, maybe higher. So we wrote a second letter with an overwhelming majority of faculty members and getting 35 and one more joined after to agree on a single letter among lawyers is like almost impossible. But we had broad agreement that these principles were clear, this analysis of law. So that's why we did the second letter, in order to clarify to any doubters that there was any disagreement about the conclusion.
And then after the first letter, we all got, I think, the email or, you know, this response. But I don't, was there something that was sent directly to the people who had, you know, written the letter?
Yes. So the principal wrote to the law professors, and she basically says, as you know, we're not allowed to do this after we had spent how many pages arguing the opposite. So she knows better than her faculty of law about what the law states, basically. And that was it. She did not address the issue of discrimination. She did not address any liability issues should the university be sued for being substandard in terms of the precautions they were taking.
And so as a member of faculty, I think students, we imagine that professors have more power than they maybe do, because there are, you know, faculty councils or departments that have a sort of a local decision-making power. And then there's the Senate, which I imagine has, you know, some higher up powers to make some decisions. But why don't either of these bodies have a say in this one?
That's a good question that one should pose to the provost. He claimed powers that we do not believe that the McGill Constitution, if you wish, provided. So we're incorporated federally. There's something called the McGill Statute, which is kind of like a bylaw that sets out who has powers. The provost proclaimed himself to have certain powers. Faculty council and our faculty last week told him he was wrong. So there's a taking of power. There's one of the problems has been over the last 20 years is that Senate's makeup has changed. So it used to be really representative of faculty and students, but over time, more and more official administrators have sat on Senate. So it's about 50-50 now. So unless you've got every single independent faculty member organized, which is very difficult, it's very hard to do much in Senate. And so Senate has become more of a body to hear from the administration than a real deliberative body that it used to be. But this is not the current administration only. It's been a trend for at least 20 years, if not longer. I only got here 20 years ago, so I can't speak to beforehand. But it's been a slow erosion. We're not the only university that has gone this way. There's been the central administration. There's a frustration when you've got a whole bunch of faculty members going off all kinds of directions. There's no unitary voice. So if you're an administrator, there's a natural desire to try to bring all these little cats into line, so that if you're, you know, arguing for the more money or this or that, you can align your public statements with what's going on internally. But that contradicts the collegial nature of a university. So it's always been a tension. As I said, the faculty members, and they have to take some responsibility, have let this happen over 20 years. And we're in a situation where the Senate now is not a real deliberative body. It really passes what the administration. So once in a while, there's a protest. So a few years ago, there was a motion to get the university to think about divestment of fossil fuels. But it was pretty weak because the administration was able to contain it. They often switch active motions to do something into a general discussion, and everybody feels good because they've discussed it, but nothing changes. You know, the university's administration said, well, we'll take it under advisement, but there's no evidence they ever do. In fact, there was a motion put forward to Senate on the issue of a proof of vaccine requirement, and the steering committee, which is controlled by the administration, didn't allow it to go forward. Instead, they put on a general discussion. So the mechanics of how it works does not is not really amenable to a full discussion and decision-making there. So a lot of the structures that, you know, come out of our long history as universities to really ensure that decisions are made locally in the, you know, kind of, you know, if you think about the European Union, instead of making it up on top, you have the subsidiarity principle, you push it down. The same thing was true of universities, that, you know, the best place to make decisions about how to teach law students is in the law faculty. That has been eroded to a certain extent. And the provost Fiat in his memo of August 29th is an illustration where the provost claimed a power he didn't have, probably counting on no deliberative body being able to push back on him. But we were able to organize the Faculty of Law so that we had 2/3 of faculty council saying he was wrong. But that, you know, we're the only one so far. It's going up to arts next week, so we'll see what happens.
There are some, you know, more practical, technical things that we think of when we're considering a vaccine mandate and why doesn't Miguel just, you know, go ahead and do it? And so I'm thinking maybe it's because Miguel doesn't want to admit that its classrooms just can't accommodate online and in-person teaching, and because it has almost like it's been told by the Quebec government that it has to have in-person teaching, it's just trying to make everyone happy?
Well, the in-person teaching is not true because Concordia allows any professor to go online, Laval basically the same. There's certainly nothing about recording and making it available. There's nothing prohibiting hybrid ways of teaching, partly online, partly in person. So there are a whole bunch of things McGill could be doing that our sister universities are doing. There is clearly a financial link between how many people you can stuff into a classroom and the revenues you get, because the university, it's a complicated formula, but basically each head brings in a certain amount of money from the province. And so stuffing more people in helps. But that should not prevent us from looking at online options. Many classrooms have recording capacity now, not all, but many do. And so it would be possible to teach enough classes, either hybrid or online, to really lighten the load. So if we took a bunch of classes and moved them online, and then we moved some of the medium-sized classes into the very large classrooms, you could decrease congestion in the classroom and still have some in-person learning. There are lots of things that McGill could do in addition to the proof of vaccination. Clearly the proof of vaccination would help a lot, because, you know, what gets you infected is the cloud of viruses out there. Every vaccinated person is putting out less than an unvaccinated, and it hangs in the air. Poor ventilation is contributing to the problem. McGill doesn't even measure the air, you know, you're supposed to change air 4 to 6 times an hour for COVID. McGill has no idea. They tell us not to use portable HEPA filters, which the CDC and everybody else says to use to clean the air. So they don't want that. So we have higher levels of virus in the air. You can fix that by getting people vaccinated, by decreasing, by having more distancing, by having, you know, fewer people in the classroom, by putting some people online. So there are a whole bunch of things they could do that would not cost it a lot. And yes, they might have inadequate infrastructure, but you can work around that, right? You could have some in-person classrooms. It might limit students' choice to a certain extent, but there are enough workarounds that those students who were vulnerable would have a real choice between showing up on campus and getting online services. Is it ideal? No, especially so late in the game. But is it worth doing to protect one's health? Yes.
So going back to, I guess, what does require a vaccine mandate, the news is now that students will have to prove vaccination status, but not staff, I think. Ironically, there's just this sort of distinguishing about who can access our libraries. Does that to you suggest that maybe the university is opening or softening its position?
It suggests to me that the university has no principled view on vaccine requirements, and that they're scrambling for something to get them out of the mess that they have created, because it makes no sense, right? The argument that students need a vaccine passport is, while the library is essential, right, like the rest of us, students can access the materials online. Well, guess what? Classes are essential and you can access them online. So there's no principled argument. Once you accept one, you realize that the university is not acting on principle, is not acting on the basis of some imaginary legal requirement, but is scrambling to look better. Why they don't do the right thing, I have no clue at this point. The easiest thing for them. The problem is, if they change things tomorrow, my fear is nobody would trust them. So even if they did all the right things tomorrow, there is such a breach of trust.
Vous écoutez une émission de Legalese sur CKUT 90.3 FM. That's all from us today. Thank you for listening, and thanks to everyone who contributed to the show.
Butcher T's noontime cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.